begin getting to some physics. We've been through some rather painful mathematical machinery in the last few days. And so today the reward will be to do a tiny bit of physics. But before we do so, I want to discuss for you the trajectories of particles in space-time. And these are described by the geodesic equation. Okay, so let's go back to what we were discussing last week, where we have in mind a manifold, some curved space-time. Now we know how to discuss the curvature. The curvature is related to the Riemann tensor. Okay, so we've got some curved manifold here with two coordinate patches, x and x prime. And we consider some curve on the manifold. Okay, so the curve on the manifold, M, is specified by the coordinates as some function of a parameter along the curve. Okay, so I just label every coordinate on the curve with some value of the parameter. Along the curve, so u is just some number going from minus infinity to infinity, and at each value of u, this every space-time coordinate is a function of that u. And in the x coordinate system, it will be x mu of u, and in the x prime coordinate system, it's x prime mu of u. Okay, so it's just important to bear in mind this is actually exactly the same curve, it's just given in different coordinate systems. So now let's discuss the tangent vector to the curve. And that's just given by dx mu du, just the derivative of the coordinate. And we'll call that xi mu. And in the x prime coordinate system, of course, it's just dx prime mu du, which is psi prime mu of u. Okay, but of course, the curve x prime mu of u, what does that actually mean? It means the x prime coordinate corresponding to the parameter value u. But the x prime coordinate is, of course, a function of the x coordinates, okay, which themselves are functions of u. And so you can think, so x prime of u must just be the same as x prime, the coordinate transformation from x to x prime, right, where I stick in u as the so it's where the x alpha of u here is the curve in the x coordinates. Okay, so it follows that dx prime du, or psi prime, psi mu prime, which is dx prime mu du, is just given by differentiating this function of u. And now I use the chain rule, which tells me that that's just given by dx beta, that's given by dx beta du. So I differentiate the argument with respect to u. And then I differentiate the function with respect to x alpha. Okay? So all we're doing here is differentiating this function of x of u with respect to u. So first of all, I get the derivative of the function, which are these dx prime u dx alpha. and then I differentiate each beta, and then I differentiate each x beta with respect to u, and so of course that's equal to dx prime mu dx beta times xi beta. So xi mu is a vector. Xi mu is a contravariant vector. Okay, because it transforms in the correct way for a vector as we go from the coordinates x to the coordinates x prime. Okay, so the tangent vector to a curve is a vector, is a contravariant vector. So now we discuss, now we define a but, okay, so that's the velocity. Okay, I've got some coordinates along u, and the xi mu is basically the velocity. It's just the differential of the coordinates with respect to the parameter u. You can think of u as like a time. Okay, it's not the space-time coordinate time, but it's like a time along the curve. And it's actually completely arbitrary. You could re-parameterize this curve. You could pick any other function of u to be the parameter along the curve, provided it was monotonic, didn't have a vanishing first derivative. Any other function would be just as good as a parameter along the curve. But d xi mu du, this is like the acceleration, right, is not a vector. This is not a contravariant vector. Okay, so the acceleration is not a contravariant vector. How can I so we define another kind of derivative, d xi mu, this is a capital D, du, and this is, so how should I define the derivative if I want it to be a vector? If I want the derivative of the vector to actually be a vector, how should I define the derivative based on everything we've said before? Need some corrections, right? Because this thing will not transform in the correct way to be a vector when I go from x to x prime. How do I make it transform correctly? Yeah?
Try to make the coordinate transformation and then see what is the vector and then come up with something.
You can, but we already know the how to correct the bad term. Right? We already know how to correct the bad term. If I have this, then this d by dx mu is not a vector. So what did I do to correct that? We add the connection, right? Okay, so that was a vector. So that suggests that we shouldn't take ordinary derivatives along the curve. We should instead take this kind of derivative, which is equal to the ordinary derivative along the curve, plus a Christoffel symbol or connection. Yep. Sorry, is what the size? Oh, sorry. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, in fact, let me just do it. Let me do it more generally. Okay, I'll do it more generally first. A special case is psi. So consider a vector V alpha of u, right, on a curve. all right, then dv mu d tau is not a covariant factor. This is a covariant factor. So we'll just define this with an arbitrary b. So I should have said that. Okay, this is called, and so we say if dv mu du equals 0, we say v mu u is parallel transported. Along a curve. Okay, so that, and I should say that that is a contravariant factor. Okay, so providing along the curve. It's along the curve x mu of u. Okay, so why is this going to be a why is that going to be a contravariant vector? And it's for the simple reason that v prime mu is going to be equal to dx prime mu dx. Well, yeah, it's going to be dx prime mu dx alpha v alpha. Okay, and now I have to regard everything as a function of u. Okay. And I think of evaluating this also as a function of u. And so when I differentiate this, I will get some bad terms. I'll get a second derivative of x prime with respect to x. But this term will be just the transformation of gamma to gamma prime will be exactly such as to cancel that bad term. Yeah. Sorry, contravariant. Contravariant. Thanks. Okay, so this is the definition of parallel transport. If I have a curve and I have some, so that's the general definition. If I have some vector that is defined along this curve, then if the vector has zero covariant derivative along the curve, so we can say d by du is a covariant derivative. Derivative along the curve. And so if the covariant derivative is zero, then basically that is saying that this vector does not change does not change as we propagate it along the curve.
Does that mean that the angle that it makes with the curve stays constant?
That's a good question. It should do. Just see how we prove that. fact, I think it means something more general, which is that if there are any two vectors which you transport along a curve, the angle between them is constant, not just between this and that. Let me think how you prove that. Yeah, actually, it's easy to prove because let me consider the angle. This will be an example of something more general. So imagine I have two curves, two vectors, right? A particular case will be the psi mu, which is the vector along the curve. But let's just take two to be completely general. What is the angle between these two vectors? How do I even define that? Okay, they both have upstairs indices. What do I do with them to get an angle? Use the metric. It's the only thing you can do. Okay, so the angle between S mu and V mu. Okay. All I can do is contract with the metric. And so obviously what I want to do is evaluate each of these things on the curve. So I'm actually considering g mu nu of x of u, right? Because x, the coordinate x, is a function of u, and g is a function of x. So this is really g of x of u. And we would call that cosine theta magnitude of v magnitude of s. Okay? Where magnitude of v squared is g mu nu v mu v nu. And the same for s. Okay, so just the cosine formula. So you'd call that that angle. So let me take a simple case, e.g., let's pick v equals s equals 1. Just imagine I have two vectors of unit length, which are propagating along the curve. And let's calculate d by du of this guy. So I'm going to write it this way. I just lowered the index on one of them. And now I'll use the fact that the covariant derivative on something with a lowered index, right, involves a minus sign here. Right? Covariant derivatives, to get a tensor, you had to use plus for upstairs, minus for downstairs. So when I differentiate the v mu, I'm going to get d mu mu du s mu plus d v mu ds mu du, and then plus gamma mu alpha v alpha s mu. And then I've got some index beta dx beta du. I should have had a minus there, right? Because it's got a downstairs index. So I'm sorry. I really want to calculate this covariant derivative of that quantity, right? So the covariant derivative of this quantity means this is the term coming from the v. And then over here, I've got the term coming from the s. That now is a plus v mu, and then I've got gamma mu alpha s mu dx mu du s alpha. Okay, and if we are lucky, those two terms cancel. Okay, so this is equal to d by du of v mu s mu. And if this equals 0, if it equals 0, then, well, if V and S are parallel transported, right, then this is zero. So if V mu and S mu were parallel transported, then this is zero. Okay, so I did it just for V dot S, but obviously if that is true, then V dot V is also d by d. If V is parallel transported, then V dot V has zero d by du. And similarly for S, so actually this angle is preserved. Yeah?
The derivative you said should be a capital V instead of a small V.
This one?
When mu is a scalar, the type of derivative shouldn't matter. It's only when we apply the derivative in vectors that you should be careful with.
Absolutely true. Okay, absolutely
so
true.
So what does it mean, the final result?
Well, all I've proven is that this equals... No, so what I said is completely consistent with what you said. I calculated the covariant derivative of a scalar, and I got the ordinary derivative of a scalar. And that's because the Christoffel symbols cancel. So it's part of a very general idea. Imagine I have any tensor and any other tensor, and I contract it to make a scalar. Now, if I take the covariant derivative of this, well, there are two ways to work this out. One of them is to think, this is a scalar. It doesn't have any indices, so I don't need any Christoffel symbols. Okay, so this is just equal to the ordinary derivative. The other way is to use the fact that the covariant derivative obeys a Leibniz rule, right? Meaning that when I differentiate Ts, that's the same as covariant derivative times T. So that's one way. The other way is to say that this is equal to d mu t alpha beta times s alpha beta plus t alpha beta times d mu s alpha beta. That's also true. Okay, that's the Leibniz rule. Can you see? So there are two ways to work this out. One is just to use the fact that it's a scalar, and the other is to just treat these as tensors. And what must happen is that the Christoffel symbols in these two expressions have to cancel. And it's obvious they do, because this has two plus Christoffel symbols, and this one has two minus Christoffel symbols, and they will cancel. Mm-hmm.
When you say parallel transport, it should be the big D.
Yeah, big parallel transport, this means that D by du of V mu equals d by du of s mu equals zero. That's what parallel transport means. Okay, that was the definition of parallel transport. If any vector obeying this equation equals zero, here it is parallel transported. So two vectors which are parallel transported, their length is independent of u, and their lengths separately are independent of u, and the angle between them is independent of you. Any other questions? Yeah.
To show the angle preserved, I think you work from the bottom up. You consider the change of the angle, which is that ddu of the inner product, right? The bottom line there.
Yeah.
And then you can show, because it's a scalar, the
positive. Yeah. That's
and then
correct.
Everything cancels in that expression you've written. If it's parallel transported, you can factor the terms. And then since S is parallel transported, V mu times ds plus the other term with the V sub mu goes to zero. Like everything goes to zero there.
Yeah.
So
yeah. No, So if we ask what is the derivative of this quantity along the curve, then the logic would be calculate the derivative of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you notice it's a scalar.
Yeah.
On a scalar, an ordinary derivative is the same as a covariant derivative. Okay? But the covariant derivative obeys this Leibniz. I should have got the logic a little different. Okay. D by du of what do we want? D mu s nu. That's what we want to know. And that's equal to d by du of v mu s u, because it's a scalar. And then we know that this is a Leibniz rule, so So that's dv mu du s mu plus v mu ds mu du. But these are parallel transported, so both terms are zero. Okay.
I'm not sure why, if the angle between them is preserved, that means it's always perpendicular to the curve.
No, it's not perpendicular to the curve.
Oh, not perpendicular, but the angle to the curve is preserved.
The angle to the curve is preserved.
Why?
Because, okay, so we proved this much more generally. We took any vector on the curve that was parallel transported, right? So S was any vector that was parallel transported, V was any vector that was parallel. A special case, and what we've proved here is that this is zero, and also the lengths are preserved, right? D by du of V mu will be zero by the same argument, and S dot S. Now, a special case is to take S mu equal to psi mu, which is the tangent vector. Right, so this would be S mu equals psi mu. That's just a special case. So the angle between any vector and the tangent vector is also preserved by just the same argument. Psi mu is parallel transported. Good point. Sorry. No. If psi mu is parallel transported, the curve is a geodesic. We're going to come to that. Okay, so far I didn't say anything. I just defined parallel transport. Okay, the condition for psi mu to be parallel transported along the curve, the tangent to be parallel transported, is that the curve is a geodesic. Okay, I haven't even got to geodesic yet, so you're jumping ahead. So that's good. So now let's talk about geodesic curves. And these are the curves that particles follow, in freely falling particles follow in space-time. And we say that x mu of u is geodesic if the psi vector is actually slightly more general than being parallel transported. If the psi vector is proportional to, sorry, the derivative of the psi vector is proportional to the psi vector. Okay? And you'll see why we make it slightly more general in a moment. So it's not that psi is parallel transported in any parametrization u. Okay? It turns out that in an arbitrary parametrization mu, the change of psi is proportional to psi. And you'll see why we make that distinction in a moment. Okay, so it's not quite, so it will then turn out, well, let me write this out in full, i.e. d2x mu du squared, right, remember psi mu is dx d mu du. So when I write that equation out, I get this, mu nu lambda dx mu du dx lambda du equals lambda of u dx mu du. So that's the equation for a geodesic. Sometimes people don't put in the last term, but it's actually necessary if you want this to be true for an arbitrary parameterization of the curve. Okay, so there's this funny last term. You see, the point is psi is dx du, right? It's the tangent to the curve. Now, I can make that tangent change along the curve just by redefining u. I mean, imagine this parameter u, doesn't go uniformly along the curve. Imagine that u goes very slowly along the curve for some stretch and then goes very quickly along the curve. What will happen? Well, then the length of psi is going to change because the meaning of u will so in other words, the meaning of psi depends on the parameterization. Okay? And so you can make psi change just by adjusting the parameterization. And that's what you want to get rid of. You don't want to count that as a sort of real thing. So anyway, this is the definition of a geodesic. And then the statement is that you can always choose an affine parameterization. So there's a special parameterization for the curve. So the right hand side to cancel the right hand side term on the right hand side. Okay, so there's a preferred set of parameterizations of every curve of a curve such that this term vanishes, and in that parameterization psi mu is parallel transported along the curve. Okay, so it's a slightly complicated thing. So what do I mean by different parameterization? If I have some curve and I say, let's parameterize it, so change the parameterization u goes to sigma of u. Okay, so u was just some parameter along the curve, and I can rechoose that parameterization any way I like, as long as it's 1-to-1. And so it means that this function sigma of u has to be monotonic in u, shouldn't be multivalued. And so then dx mu du is of course equal to d sigma du of dx mu d sigma. Okay? So I've got x mu as a function of u, and then I reparameterized it by sigma of u, and consider x as a function of sigma of u. Okay? So again, x mu of sigma of u. So that's how we go from one parameterization to another. So now I just plug this formula into the geodesic equation. Let's call that star. And what I get, so we insert this in star. And what I get is d by du of this lot. So I get d2 sigma du squared dx mu d sigma plus, now these ones are easy because d by du is just d sigma du du squared d2x mu d sigma squared plus gamma mu mu lambda dx mu d sigma dx lambda d sigma equals lambda of u d sigma du dx d sigma. Okay, so I just substituted in And what do I see? Well, here I have the left-hand side in the sigma coordinate system. And I've got this term here, which I can use to cancel that term. Okay. So you can always solve this. So we have this equation that d2 sigma du squared. So let's set d2 sigma du squared equal to lambda of u times d sigma du. Okay, that's an ordinary differential equation for sigma of u. And if I do that, these two terms cancel. Okay? And then what I'm left with is that this quantity is zero, and that's the equation for parallel transport of dx d sigma. Yeah. Yes, there is. When you discuss, for example, the dynamics of a string in string theory, so the basis of string theory is an equation just like this, which is effectively a geodesic equation for the string in space-time. And it's very useful to pick different parameterizations. Sometimes the affine parameterization is good, sometimes not. And so having that freedom to pick different parameterizations is sometimes useful. Yeah. Pardon? Oh, that was the okay. So this is the definition of affine parameterization. An affine parameterization means it's a parameterization in which this is zero. Okay. So I'll write that out in words. But let me first show you can solve this equation. So what's the solution of this equation? Does anybody know? D2 sigma du squared is lambda times d sigma du. It's a first order differential equation for d sigma du, and it's equal to what? Pardon? Exponential is a good guess. Exponential of what? Yes, so this is d by du of sigma prime. And then let's bring the sigma prime down here. And that would be lambda of u, right? And then this is the d by du of log sigma prime. And so what I see is that sigma du is the exponential e to the integral lambda of u integrated up to u. Actually, the solution is given wrong in Houston and Todd. I think they weren't concentrating. But they give the wrong solution. Doesn't matter for any reason. But if you look in Houston and Todd, they don't give the right solution. Okay. So we can always choose a parameterization. We can always parameterize or choose an affine parameterization. I'll tell you why it's called affine in a moment. For a geodesic in which I don't have the right-hand side. Okay. I.e., the tangent factor dx mu d by d sigma of dx mu d sigma equals d by d sigma of psi mu equals 0, i.e., the tangent vector is parallel transported along the curve. Okay, so with this parameterization, it should be clear that the angle between any vector defined on the curve and the tangent vector is actually constant. Now, you can ask how unique is the affine parameterization. Okay, and that's just a statement about how unique was the solution of that first order differential equation. When I had to pick sigma as a function of u, I solved that first order differential equation. And it's easy to see that the uniqueness, so sigma is unique up to sigma goes to sigma prime is can be any linear function of sigma. So I can parameterize, I can reparameterize sigma by any linear function, and I leave this alone. That's kind of obvious from here. If I change sigma, say sigma equals constant sigma prime, well, both of these terms are going to transform in the same way, so that's not going to affect the equation. Okay? And we have actually proved that that is the complete uniqueness. Okay, just the solution of this equation of d2 sigma du squared equals lambda of u d sigma du. These two are just the constants of integration in that differential equation. So in particular, so let's just, so if v mu is, well, if v mu is parallel transported on the curve, if d by d sigma of v mu equals 0, then d by d sigma of psi mu equals 0. So the angle any vector makes with a curve, with a geodesic, with a tangent to a geodesic, is preserved if that curve, if the vector is parallel transported along the curve. So in particular, d by d sigma of the length of C is preserved. Right? If I have a geodesic affinely parameterized, then the length of the tangent vector is preserved along the curve. And so, i.e., psi nu, g mu nu, is a constant of the motion. Okay? Because this derivative is equal to the ordinary derivative. Psi mu, and that's equal to d by d sigma of g mu, psi nu, right? By choosing sigma, by linear rescaling of sigma, we can choose this to be plus or minus 1 or 0. Okay, so you have a geodesic, the length of the tangent vector, the length squared of the tangent vector is a constant along the curve, the tangent vector is defined by dx mu d sigma. Okay, so if I go from sigma to sigma prime equal to a sigma, I can just rescale the tangent vector, and so I can set its length squared equal to plus 1 or minus 1 if it was non-zero. If it was 0, then it's 0 anyway. So there's a preferred parameterization for a geodesic, okay? Unique up to affine transformations, just that's the linear transformations, A sigma plus B. For a time-like curve, this quantity, what sign is this for a time-like curve? Time-like. G mu nu psi mu psi nu. What sign is it for time-like? Okay, so if this is negative, then all I'm saying is that I can use that affine freedom to rescale sigma to set this equal to minus 1. Okay, so actually when I've done that, I've totally fixed the parameterization. Okay, up to what? There's only one arbitrariness in the parameterization when I've done that. What is it? Right, remember we had the choice. Sigma prime is A sigma plus B. I've used this A up because I've set this equal to minus 1. I've still got that. Okay, so I can shift my parameter by a constant along the curve and still preserve this condition. That's it. For a null vector, so null will be a null geodesic, sine u will be 0. Okay? And then the parameter along the geodesic is still arbitrary by A sigma plus B, and there's no way to fix it. Okay, so whenever you discuss a photon, photon is going on a null geodesic, the parameter along the curve is just arbitrary up to a scale. And there's actually no way to fix that scale. It's just a parameter, and no one choice is preferred over any other. Yep.
So does this mean that just by rescaling a parameterization,
you
can go in between time-like and space-like?
Not at all. Not at
all. I guess I don't understand the very last sentence
you wrote, like a sentence in the bottom. Okay, so this quantity is a constant along the curve. What does that mean? It means if it's positive, it'll always be positive. If it's negative, it'll always be negative. Furthermore, if it's negative, I can rescale the parameters to make it minus 1.
Oh, so your last sentence does not mean by rescaling the big line, you can go between plus
not
minus.
Not at
minus
all.
Zero.
No, no.
We can go to 1 over 3.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So by using this, right, then for time-like curves, we can set it equal to this. Well, null at 0. And space-like, we can always set it equal to plus 1. If it's a space-like geodesic, then g mu nu psi mu psi nu can be set equal to plus 1 by using this freedom. Yeah.
For time-like particle, we can say, okay, in that case, sigma will be half the
time. Yes. In that case, sigma is exactly tau. Yes, and you can see that. Because if I chose this, what does that mean? It means that, so I've got g mu nu dx mu d sigma in the new parameterization, dx nu d sigma is minus 1. Okay? Now, consider some point on the curve. All right? Go to local inertial coordinates near that point. We want to make this look like flat space. Go to local inertial coordinates. In those coordinates, g is eta, right? So I use the, now this is coordinate independent because this is a tensor and those are vectors. So I can go to local inertial coordinates at the point P. Coords at P. And this becomes eta mu nu dx nu d tau dx nu d tau equals minus 1. And this means that d tau equals square root of 1, d tau is equal to dt square root 1 minus dx dt squared. So tau is indeed the proper time along the curve. Okay. Now, all this is very nice, but I essentially just plucked that equation for the geodesic out of the air, right? I just wrote down something plausible for the geodesic. To justify that equation, ultimately the justification for that equation comes from stress energy conservation. And so if I consider a particle traveling in a space-time, and I carefully work out this equation. Yeah, actually, we'll get to this in a little while. But just to sort of say that one actually has to justify that geodesic equation as following from some equations of motion, and just to mention that it really follows from stress energy conservation. We will also, at the end of this week, discuss an action principle for the geodesic equation. You can write down a variational principle which gives the geodesic equation. Okay, so I've discussed the motion of particles on a curved space, again, under the assumption that they follow this geodesic equation, which is the simplest thing you can write down, just saying that they're, roughly speaking, that their acceleration is zero. Okay, their proper acceleration is zero. There's another important equation called the equation of geodesic deviation. And that's what I want to discuss next. Okay, so I'm supposed to imagine two particles flying through space, all right, following the geodesic equation, and I want to figure out how does the separation between the particles change? Okay, because that's what somebody would see, right? If you're just flying through space in a spaceship and you want to detect the curvature of space-time, how are you going to detect this curvature? You're sitting in your spaceship and you're just traveling along. Okay, well, the way to detect it will be to release some object, right? Say I'm standing here and I'm in free fall in my spacecraft. The rocket's off, nothing's happening, I'm just weightless inside the spacecraft. And I've got my cup of coffee, right? And I let it go. Now, if I let it go so it just sits there, weightless, right, then there's no evidence for any curvature of space. I might just be traveling through completely flat space. But as I travel along and this thing starts to move away from me, right, that's a sign that there's actually a curvature of space-time. It's because the geodesics are separating.
If I have a fin in orbit, then it will always point along the curve of the orbit.
Well, it depends where you set it up. So, if that's my world line, and I'm following a geodesic, and I put this pen at some particular angle, right? So, let me just think about this. So, we've got to think in space-time, right? So, you've got to think what that angle means in space-time. If I say the pen, for example, if I'm standing here and I just stick my hand out, okay, it's pointing in some direction, but in space, right? So really, my arm is a band in space-time, right? It's falling through, it's going through space-time. And so I could, so the picture would be more accurately like this. Okay, that's the, and you could think about this as the world line of my shoulder and the world line of my fingertip. Okay? Now, to define the angle, we would actually need a clock on the end of the clock on the end of the rod, right?
Right.
So I could say, where is it at a certain time? That would define an angle. But yeah, if you do that, then you will find that that angle is just preserved along the GDC.
But let's just say, in practice, if I'm in orbit, mm-hmm. and I point my pin along the direction of motion, will it yeah. always point along the direction of motion, or will it almost like...
Yes. Yes. So, if I'm traveling along this, let's make a picture of a spaceship, and I have some object there, and then let's say I... Okay, let me just be careful here. Yeah, I think what you want to do is have some object... let me just think. Have the pen pointing along the direction of the motion.
Or well, if it's maybe something without spatial extent, like an electron with a spin pointing in the direction of something.
Right.
Like that.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just... Yeah, so you can picture a particle with a spin. That's a good example. So let's take a particle, and then, well, first of all, we have to understand what is a spin. So a spin has to be a four vector. And what's the zero component of a four vector? Okay, so a spin, it must be a four vector, right? Now I have my four velocity, which will basically be this sine u. Okay, so that's the four velocity. And then the spin has to satisfy an equation that g mu nu s mu dx mu d sigma equals zero. Okay, why? Because if I picked a coordinate system where the particle was at rest, so I've got some locally inertial coordinate system. The particle's not even moving. It's just there. So I'm just falling with the particle. Then the statement is the spin is a space-like vector. It doesn't have any time component. Okay? So in a frame in which the particle is at rest, so this would be equal to 1, so in a locally inertial frame, where the particle is at rest, that would just be 1, 0. The metric would be eta, and this quantity obeys, the four velocity obeys g mu nu psi mu equals minus 1, right? So that's time-like particle. And so this statement here, s there. So this statement tells you that S0 is 0 in this coordinate system. So I'm just traveling along with the particle, and the spin is just a spatial vector. Okay, so what all this will tell you is that I'm sitting here, the spin is orthogonal to my world line, pointing in some spatial direction. And it's just saying that if I keep going along the geodesic, the spin will remain orthogonal to the world line. Now, that doesn't tell you whether the spin changes itself. It just says it stays orthogonal to the world line. However, if I've got another spin here, then the angle between them will be preserved because they're both parallel transmission along the curve. And in practice, if you did an experiment, that's what you'd be doing. You'd always be comparing, you know, one object to the other. So there's no real meaning to saying it's in the same direction it was when I started. You need a reference spin, and then you carry it along with you, and the statement is here. So I think the correct statement is, if I've got two pens, okay, then the angle between them will always stay the same, if they're both in free fall. Okay. That was not the equation of geodesic deviation. So this equation is intuitively, it's just measuring how geodesics diverge. Right? So I've got two geodesics, and they're separated by some distance. So it's like the analog problem is in Euclidean geometry. If you have two parallel lines, right, they never meet. Take two parallel lines here and you extend them off to plus or minus infinity, they never meet. That's not true in general relativity. You can have two parallel lines, they run off, but the space is curved, and so they cross. Give me an example of the simplest space you can think of where parallel lines always cross.
Sphere.
Sphere. Exactly. So what is a geodesic on a sphere?
Great circle.
Great circle. So if I take two great circles, you know, they have to cross. So even if I set them up parallel here, let's imagine I set two parallel lines on the sphere. Well, they're both great circles. And so this one is going to go like that, and they're going to have to cross. Okay? So this was the reason that Riemann's discovery was called non-Euclidean geometry. Right? It violated the fundamental axiom of Euclidean geometry, which is that parallel lines cannot cross. Okay, so now we're going to work out the equation for geodesic deviation. So we'll start with a geodesic in affine parameterization. For some reason, I started calling sigma tau now. Okay, so we're going to consider a nearby geodesic. With coordinates x mu plus delta x mu of tau. Okay, so this is my first geodesic, with which is the curve x mu of tau. And I'm going to take a nearby geodesic with coordinates x mu plus delta x mu of tau. So let me just sketch this. So here is x mu of tau. And then my other curve is going to be there. And that will be x mu plus delta x mu of tau. And so for each tau, there's a displacement factor from one curve to the other. And that is the delta x mu. Okay, so we're going to derive an equation for delta x mu, just telling us exactly how the separation between two neighboring geodesics changes with time. So I'm going to take, this is my first geodesic equation. So we're just going to write down the geodesic equation for the second curve. And so that obeys d2 by d tau squared of x mu plus delta x mu plus gamma mu nu lambda d by d tau of x nu plus delta x nu d by d tau of x lambda plus delta x lambda equals 0. Okay, so those are my two geodesics.
Sorry, when you change from sigma to tau.
Yep.
You mean the
polynomial? No meaning. Yeah, I mean, okay. I've just relabeled it tau. Tau is the proper time.
And so we know that the proper time is an affine.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. Okay, so those are my two GD6, the original one, and the one that was slightly displaced. And if we difference these two equations, so let's work to first order. So let's call this one 1, and that one 2. And then I'll subtract 1 from 2 to first order in delta x mu. Okay, so my assumption is going to be that delta x mu is small. These two curves are nearby each other. And so when I, for example, get a cross term here, the delta x mu squared, oh, by the way, very important, this gamma is evaluated on the curve, right? So it's evaluated on that displaced curve. But when I get things which are second order in delta x, I'll just ignore them. Just going to work to first order in delta x. So I just take this equation minus that equation, and what I get is d2 d tau squared delta x mu. That's from the first term. Then I get something from here, because this gamma is not the same as that one. This is gamma at x. This is gamma at x plus dx. And so this is equal to gamma mu nu lambda comma rho delta x rho. The difference between this gamma and that gamma is just that term. And then I take these two terms to lowest order, because I've already got a linear in delta x term there. So I take these two in lowest order. So that's dx nu dtor dx lambda dtor. Okay. So that's the linear term I get from the gamma. Now, what about these two terms? Well, I can get this term, which is linear in delta x, or the other term, linear in delta x. And each time, I should take everything else to lowest order in delta x. So that gives me a factor of 2 times gamma mu mu lambda d by d tau of delta x nu times d by d tau of x lambda. Okay, so I took either this term or I took that term, but this was symmetric. Gamma is symmetric under exchanging nu and lambda, so that just gives me a factor of 2. Well, that's a bit of an ugly equation, but we shouldn't be surprised, because we're not we did something a bit dodgy, which is we worked out this difference equation, but it doesn't involve covariant derivatives, right? This is an ordinary d by d tau derivative. So what we have to do to get a nice equation is to turn this into a covariant equation. I mean, it's a correct equation, but it's coordinate dependent. It's not a tensorial equation. Yeah. How do we know that?
Yeah.
Just by definition. I'm taking tau to be the affine. Tau is the affine parameter in both cases. All right. So, just think of this as taking two curves and running them forward using the affine parameter on each curve, and then identifying the affine. You see. It's a little bit like we were discussing earlier. If I'm going to talk about this delta x nu at all right, so I've got my two curves. What does delta x nu mean? It means the x nu on one curve subtracts the x nu of the other curve at some particular parameter value. Which parameter? So if I parameterize this curve differently, the delta x nu will be completely different. So I've got to pick one parameterization and stick to it. Okay. So what I do is pick both curves to be affinely parameterized by the same affine parameter. Okay. And so the affine parameter along here is tau, and along here is tau. And then if I work out delta x nu at some particular tau, you know, that's what it means. So there's still a little bit of ambiguity, because I've told you that when you define affine parameters for a time-like geodesic, the residual ambiguity is a constant. Okay, I can. If I. So in other words, saying I have this equation doesn't uniquely specify tau. Well, this equation combined with, say, this condition, g mu nu dx nu d tau dx nu d tau equals minus 1. These are two consistent equations. Tau, I'm not allowed to rescale tau anymore, because otherwise I'd mess this equation up. But I can shift tau by a constant. So I've got these two curves, and I'm still allowed to shift tau on the curves by a constant. And I'm just living with that. That's fine. Whatever choice I make, that's I'm going to infer the corresponding delta x. Okay. So how do I get this is not doesn't look tensorial. Okay. And so obviously that suggests, let's try to write down something which does look tensorial. So let's write down this quantity. Okay, so we'll try this. The covariant derivative with respect to tau of delta x mu, and second derivative. So what's that equal to? So that is equal to the covariant derivative of d by d tau delta x mu plus gamma mu nu lambda delta x nu dx lambda d tau. And now this is equal to d2 by d tau squared. So let me first calculate the ordinary part of this, the d by d tau of all this junk, and then I'll put the gamma term in. Okay? So first we're going to do the ordinary part. And then I've got to calculate the ordinary derivative of gamma. That gives me this term, gamma mu nu lambda comma alpha of dx alpha d tor. Delta x nu dx lambda d tor. Then I've got to differentiate my delta x nu. So I've got gamma mu nu lambda d delta x nu d tor dx lambda d tor. And finally, I've got to differentiate this guy. So I get plus gamma mu nu lambda d2 x lambda d tor squared. Okay, that was the ordinary derivative part. And now I've got the gamma term coming from here. So this gives me plus gamma mu alpha beta d by d tor delta x alpha dx beta d tor. So that was the gamma with this first term. Okay, remember what gamma does is it takes this index and it puts it onto the gamma. So that's what's happening here. It's taking the index on the delta x and it's putting it onto the gamma. Now I've got the last term, which is just gamma mu alpha beta gamma alpha nu lambda delta x nu dx lambda detour dx beta detour. Okay, and that's everything. Okay, so now let us try to simplify this equation. Now I know this, you see, from here. I have this equation for d2 d tau squared of delta x nu. So I'm just going to use that to replace it with this stuff. So that will give me minus gamma mu nu lambda comma rho delta x rho dx nu detour dx lambda detour. Okay, the first term. And then I'll get this one, minus 2 gamma mu nu lambda d by detour delta x nu d by detour x lambda. Okay. And what you will notice, actually let me not do that, so I'll just leave that in here. I'll cross out the term that I've substituted for. Chalk. Okay, so I've now just substituted for that term using this equation. And now some things are going to cancel. In particular, everything involving the d by detour of delta x nu is going to cancel, because you see I've got this term and I've got this term involving d by detour of delta x alpha, and I've got two of those. Okay? And these are all the same term. So they all cancel. So this, this, and this cancel. Okay, can you see what's emerging? What am I left with? I've got some derivatives of gamma. I've got some squares of gamma. What does that remind you of? Should remind you of something. What's the first equation I wrote down today? Riemann tensor. Okay, so the geodesic deviation is just given by the Riemann tensor. So let's try to get all the terms right. Sorry? This one here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, sorry, I got tired. Delta x nu. Yep, that's right. Okay, so again, it's one of these kind of miracles that the derivative of delta x vanishes or cancels, but the delta leaving us something just proportional to delta x. And now, let me see. I'm just a little bit confused about one term. Ah, yes. I've got to do one other thing. In this very term, I've got d2x detour squared, right? And that's the x. That's the original geodesic. So here, I can use the unperturbed geodesic equation. So this term here gets replaced. Let me draw an arrow down here. This term becomes gamma mu nu lambda times minus gamma lambda alpha beta dx alpha detour dx beta detour delta x nu. Okay? So here I'm just using the geodesic equation. Pardon? Yeah, exactly. So I'm just using equation one. Okay, so now I obviously have everything I need for the Riemann tensor because I have one derivative of gamma, another derivative of gamma, and then two terms quadratic in gamma. Okay, so we'd now just have to collect all those terms. And so this is equal to minus It's equal to bracket minus gamma mu nu lambda comma rho plus gamma mu rho nu comma lambda delta x rho x dot mu x dot lambda. So let's see. That is just this term. Okay, the first one is just, so I can label these things. One is just one. And I have another derivative of gamma here, two. All right, so two, the delta x is contracted with the first index, which I've called rho in that expression. And then I have the other two terms. So that one is two. And then I've got some other things in here. Minus gamma mu rho gamma 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 nu lambda. Let's see where that comes from. Comes from this term. So the second gamma is this one with its indices contracted with the dx detour. The delta x nu is contracted with the first index there. Then I have the mu lambda. And so that was three. That's this term over here, three. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth term is just the other one. Gamma mu, gamma lambda, gamma, gamma rho nu. Okay, and all that's inside the brackets. And that is equal to the Riemann tensor, nu lambda rho, delta x rho, x dot nu, x dot, well, let's write it out, dx nu, detour, dx, lambda detour. Okay, so we get this really nice equation, the d2 of delta x mu detour squared is equal to the Riemann tensor. Okay, so that's how you measure the curvature of space-time, is you just consider the convergence or divergence of neighboring geodesics. And that's what the Riemann tensor measures. Okay, so now we are ready to recover Newton's law of gravitation. Okay, obviously, if this is a theory of gravity, it better recover Newton's theory of gravity. So we're going to consider a slow-moving particle. Okay, now this is actually, even when I say slow-moving particle, you have to bear in mind I have all this freedom to choose frames and coordinates and everything else. So I've got a particle which is slow-moving in a particular coordinate system, which I have chosen to make it slow moving. Okay? That's the first assumption. So we can actually always choose a coordinate system where this is true. And what that means is that the magnitude of dx detour is much less than the magnitude of dt detour. Right? Because the magnitude of dx dt, that's the velocity, magnitude of velocity, is much less than c. Actually, I should have put a c in here. Ct. My x naught coordinate is always ct. Okay, so I've got a slow-moving particle, and so the geodesic equation becomes d2x mu detour squared plus gamma mu. Now, the point is that the dx detour involving the spatial x's are small, so let's just ignore them. So instead of having this expression, dx alpha detour dx beta detour, right, I'm going to ignore everything with a spatial index here because it's small. So that I replace by gamma naught naught d of x naught detour dx naught. And of course, x naught is ct. Okay, so now we're going to make another assumption. We're going to assume the one, the metric is stationary. Okay, so that means independent of time. So this is very plausible that if I'm thinking about the metric of the sun and I'm interested in the Earth's orbit around the sun, then the space-time around the sun is static. It's not changing. That means the metric should be static. So that means d by detour of g mu nu should be 0. There are no time derivatives of the metric. So now we'll calculate this Christoffel symbol, gamma mu naught naught. Well, what's it equal to? Well, we go back to the formula we derived, assuming no torsion. And this will give us g0 alpha comma 0 plus g0 alpha comma 0 minus g0 0 comma alpha. Right? There were three terms. Now, because this is static, the first two terms are 0. And so this is just equal to. And furthermore, the alpha index can only be a spatial one because the metric's independent of, and so what that leads to, well, let's see. Yeah, no, that's right. Let's leave it for this at the moment. A half g mu alpha g naught naught comma alpha. All right, so secondly, we're going to assume that the gravitational field is weak. Okay, so that's the assumption that the metric is eta mu nu plus h mu nu. Okay, and that means globally. It's not just at a point, it means everywhere. At least everywhere that this particle we're following will travel. Okay, where the magnitude of the h mu nu is much less than 1. So h mu nu, which is the metric perturbation, it's a dimensionless 4x4 matrix, and the magnitude of all the matrix elements should be small. Well, what does this mean? It means that gamma mu 0, 0 which is the only component we need for the geodesic equation. It's given by this, but you see the eta is independent of the coordinates. So the only derivative term, the only term in that g naught naught alpha comes from the h naught naught. And that's already first order in h. And so I can forget about any h coming from this inverse metric. Okay, so by the way, the inverse metric to linear order in h is just given by eta alpha beta with raised indices minus h alpha beta plus order h squared. Okay, so that's just saying if I have a matrix 1 plus a, its inverse is 1 minus a up to order a squared terms. But this inverse metric, I already have an h here, something of order h in the second term. And so I can ignore anything of h coming from the first term. And so gamma mu 0, 0 is equal to minus 1 half eta mu nu h 0, 0, comma, I guess I called it alpha or something, alpha, right, plus order h squared. So then the geodesic equation is d2xi dtor squared equals, from that equation, minus gamma I naught naught d of ct dtor squared. And that's equal to 1 half gradient I h naught naught d of ct dtor squared. So that's the I component. This is for mu equals I. And if mu equals 0 in the geodesic equation, then I have d2 of ct by dtor squared equal to 0. Okay? Because you see, if this index is 0, if the mu index is 0, that means this index is 0. Alpha has to be 0 to get a non-zero answer. But the derivative with respect to the 0 coordinate, which is ct, is 0. By assumption, dt of h naught naught equals 0. Okay, so these are my geodesic equations. And let's call that one 1 and this one 2. Now, 2 is easy to solve. This implies t, or ct, is linear in tau. Okay, ct is a tor plus b. Yeah. Here, this one. Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Where by definition, this is h. Yes, this is eta alpha gamma eta beta delta h gamma delta. We didn't use it in the formula because we didn't need that term anyway. Because the key point is that the downstairs h, you know, that everything was proportional to one factor of h just from that. So we didn't. We could just replace the metric, upstairs metric, with eta. Okay, so ct is linear in tor. And now we go back to equation 1. And if ct is linear in tor, then I can just replace this d2 dtor squared with d2 dt squared. And well, essentially I can just cancel these detour squared on the left and the right-hand side if CT is linear in tor, because when you do a linear transformation from tor to T, there's no, there's only a constant factor, and it'll be the same constant factor here as there will there. And so that implies that 1 becomes d2xi dt squared. Now I'm going to try to keep my c's straight. And so this is equal to 1 half grad I h naught naught with a factor of c squared. Okay, so you should always remember the metric is dimensionless. Metric has no dimensions at all. And so when I write down equation, here I've got spatial derivative, and there I've got an acceleration. So that's length over time squared, and so I need a length squared over time squared to make the dimensions work. So luckily they do. And let's compare that to Newton. So Newton said that the acceleration of a particle, dt squared, was equal to minus the gradient of the gravitational potential. Okay, and so what we see from this is, again, we've got the gradient. And so we can identify that h naught naught equals, so for agreement, h naught naught must be minus 2 phi over c squared. Or g naught naught, the time-time components of the metric, must be 1 plus 2 phi over c squared. So for example, for a spherical mass, the Newtonian potential is minus gm over r if you're at a radius r from the mass. And so this h naught naught is equal to 2gm over r c squared. And that's a dimensionless number. Okay, so if you work out this number, it's 10 to the minus 9 on the surface of the Earth. It's 10 to the minus 6 on the surface of the Sun. And it's 10 to the minus 1 on the surface of a neutron star. Okay. And so that's telling you that H is not so small on a neutron star. Okay, what is it on a black hole? How big do you think H is? Yeah, it's 1. Okay. And you see, if H is plus 1, what does that mean? If H naught naught is plus 1, so our metric is g naught naught is eta naught naught plus h naught naught. What happens if h is plus 1? Eta naught naught is minus 1, right? If this is, phi is negative, so this is positive. So if it gets very, very strong, h naught goes to 1, well, g naught naught vanishes. And that's a bit of a problem, okay? The metric vanishes. What does that indicate? Yeah.
The weak field approximation doesn't work for a strong field.
That's right. You're absolutely right. But in fact, it turns out that this formula does work for a strong field. This really is true. That's the metric in Schwarzschild coordinates for a black hole. That's g naught naught with this 1 minus 2gm over rc squared. And so when you go to the radius of the black hole, that's when that number, the g naught naught, vanishes. That's called a horizon, event horizon. So it's a very, very important effect. Basically, it's telling you light cannot escape from such an object. That's why it's called a black hole. So you already get some clues that some funny things may go on if you consider, very strong gravitational fields. But you're right. Now, one facet of this, you notice something totally obvious that happened, but this was, in fact, the main motivation for Einstein's theory, is that the main experimental evidence at the time, which motivated him, was the equivalence of inertial and gravitational masses. Okay? So when you write down Newton's equation, normally you put a mass here and a mass there. Okay? This is F equals ma, and then the statement is that the gravitational force on a mass is proportional to the mass. Right? And then it was just an empirical fact that these two masses happened to agree, and nobody knew why. But in Einstein's theory, they're obviously the same. Okay? And the reason is that all particles live in the same space-time. And they're all seeing the same metric, and so when they follow geodesics, they're all following the same geodesics, and it's completely independent of the mass. So gravity is a fictitious force in that sense. Gravity doesn't really exist, just that space-time is curved. All right. So that was kind of a clue that this was a clue to the structure of the whole theory, that the equivalent of inertial mass, the mass on the left-hand side of Newton's equation, and gravitational mass, the mass that comes into the force on the right-hand side of Newton's equation. Okay, so, yeah. No, because photon is null. Okay. But the statement is, I should say it more carefully. Say I've got a gravitational field like the one due to the sun, due to a big object. And now I consider the motion of any small object. And by small, you mean that the object itself is not going to distort the space-time. So any small object, providing it's small enough not to distort the space-time itself, will follow the same trajectory. So whether it's a brick or a stone or it's made out of steel or whatever it's made out of, it falls in a gravitational field in exactly the same way. But that is only true if the object is small enough not to affect the space-time. The space-time must have been created or the result of some bigger mass. Okay, so I think we are ready to do Einstein's field equations, but maybe we should just start with that tomorrow, since we've already gone on a lot. Any other questions? Yeah.
You still put a bit in the earlier on, right? Gravitational mass equals inertia. It's still in this different phrasing.
Yeah, I mean, it was built in that sense. The formulation of the equivalence principle is that the laws of physics in the right coordinate system should just be those without gravity within a local vicinity. So that was already saying gravity is sort of an illusion. Once you have that picture, then you start to ask, how do particles actually move? Then you find they are moving, they're moving independent of their mass. So that's not quite the same statement. I mean, I think it's just a statement that all particles live in the same space-time. And their motion is not affected by their mass. So again, the philosophy is similar, that there is no such thing as gravity. Okay? That once you account for the curvature of space-time, there's nothing else. There's no other gravitational force. But I think they're two separate statements. the local laws of physics are independent of gravity, and secondly, the motion of a particle is independent of its mass. Okay. Any other last minute questions?
The lunch today is at the bistro, but it will start at 1 o'clock. Okay. And the tutorial starts at 2:30. There is a kind of a sheet for the different
segment. So Dennis, when does relativity tutorial start then? 4 o'clock?
Well, the relativity tutorial was pretty speaking it starts at 4 o'clock, but typically people ask to give the tutorial problems from the very beginning.
It's just so much fun.
So the tutorial is going to be tough today, so you will have to do a lot of algebra.